Welcome to The Wrap Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sharon Waxman, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Joining me is my co-host, Daniel Goldblatt, our assistant managing editor. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, Sharon. Happy July 4th weekend.
Happy July 4th weekend. Yep. It's going to be a hot one by all accounts. And it's hot in the news too, isn't it?
Oh, it was a crazy week.
It was a pretty crazy week, like really still trying to catch my breath. A lot to talk about this week. There are a lot of women's issues in the news this week, which we're going to be talking about shortly. And we thought it would be a good time to talk to Emily Vogel, who's on our Wrap Women team. Emily not only writes our Wrap Women newsletter, which comes out twice a month and is delightful, encourage you to sign up for it, but she'll also be launching a new podcast for women in entertainment and media in the coming weeks. So you'll get to hear her perspective.
I can't wait. I'm excited for her podcast. And also we're going to have for you The Wrap's TV reporter Jenny Moss recently sat down with Leslie Headland. Besides being the creator and showrunner of Netflix's Fantastic Russian Doll, she is also the first queer woman to direct a Star Wars title, the upcoming Disney Plus series, The Acolyte. She talked about that and how Phantom Menace, the 1998 film, played a role in her coming out story. But first, Sharon, let's get into some headlines.
Let's go.
You know, I can't believe this is a sentence I'm saying. Bill Cosby was released from prison on Wednesday after the Pennsylvania Supreme Court overturned his 2018 sexual assault conviction. The court ruled that current District Attorney Kevin Steele was obligated to stand by his predecessor's promise not to charge Cosby with any crimes when the comedian agreed to give potentially incriminating testimony in Andrea Constand's civil case, Constand being the alleged victim in the criminal case. Cosby released a statement saying that he has always maintained his innocence, while Constand and her lawyers called the ruling disappointing and feared that the decision may, quote, discourage those who seek justice for sexual assault, end quote. Sharon, I felt like this news came completely out of left field. How are you feeling about all this?
Yeah, I think I'm feeling like most people are feeling, which is kind of like you've been hit on the side of the head, because we weren't expecting it. Although, if you read the coverage, his lawyers were expecting it because they had appealed, on this basis. And it turned out that really was only one part of the appeal that was enough to overturn. I mean, not just, just to overturn the verdict of a jury and get him out of jail that same day. So I will say this. The basis upon which the Supreme Court made the decision to release him and reverse the verdict sounded, and I'm not a lawyer and I haven't read every document in this case, but it sounded sound to me, because what they were saying is that the DA promised Cosby that he would not be incriminating himself if he participated on the civil side of this case and talked honestly about what he did. And so Cosby took the stand and talked about drugging women for sex. And the Supreme Court found that it was, disingenuous and that Cosby was denied due process and his constitutional rights when he was convicted partly on the basis of that testimony. That Right. sounds right to me. So people keep saying that he's released on a technicality, which would be the technicality, but it's a pretty big technicality. If it's like if you're saying, okay, we're going to take the death penalty off the table, serial murderer. Now tell us where all the bodies are so we can give the families of your victims some peace and they can go bury their dead. And then you'd say, oh, sorry, we're actually going to give you the electric chair. Sorry. Like that doesn't sound like it's a good practice that we should be supportive of in our justice system. At the same time, of course, you understand how betrayed all these victims feel, even though these are not all the 60 women who came out with allegations against him who were involved in this case. It's Andrea Constand's case. And of course, there are other charges, I imagine, that can be brought against him. Many of them have passed the statute of limitations. But it just feels like a gut punch. It's a blow to the Me Too movement. There's no doubt about it. And it just feels like it's so hard to make progress and have it stick. How do you feel?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're 100% right in everything you said, that objectively, when you read this story, you can see how it got to this point. There was a deal made. The prosecutor then went back on that deal.
Yeah.
And it seems like to me he probably could have made his case differently and maybe not and lived in the spirit of the deal, but he didn't. And yeah, I mean, you know, these victories that we get in the Me Too movement feel great when they happen. They feel like progress, and to have the rug pulled out from underneath you on one of the biggest ones has to be just like a gut punch, you know, and basically in this particular case, the conviction wasn't overturned because anyone thinks he didn't do it. It's just right. It is a technicality, but a correct one. But still, it's just like, even when someone is guilty, they still get out. It's just, it's very disheartening.
Who is demonstrably guilty gets out, while so many other people pay incredibly steep prices for much more minor infractions, you know, or, you know, the women feel like they can't be taken seriously. And I think that there is a concern that when something like this happens, it discourages other women who might have felt encouraged to step forward and tell the truth. And they don't want to do it anymore because they're afraid that it's going to not only brand them forever rape, because who the hell wants to go through life like that? You know, put a target on your back from people who are bizarrely, and who knows why, find that that is offensive to them in some way, that anybody would call out a hero, whether it's a Michael Jackson or a Bill Cosby or anybody, right? And finally, that they don't actually get justice on the other side of it, even when they are willing to step up. That is the worry when something like this happens. So yes, even, you know, let's have a judicial system where everybody plays by the rules. That sure would be nice. And that when people are willing to stand up and say and name their assaulter and name a rapist, and even when it is somebody rich or famous or powerful or beloved in the eyes of the public, which Bill Cosby was for decades and decades, that you still can be heard and your case can be adjudicated by the law. That is the part that I think is very chilling to the Me Too movement, frankly.
Yeah, and I think that was reflected in Andrea Constant's statement, that she was worried that this would discourage people from seeking justice. And it's hard not to see that happening. I mean, if I were a victim and I wanted to come forward, what do I have like one case to look at. Well, Harvey Weinstein, to be like, oh, justice got served once. What are the odds I'm going to be number two? Like, it's
well, and I there has to be. And so let's just go on with our headlines here, because I think this was another tough piece of news for women in general, even though it affected one person, Britney Spears, which is that Britney Spears' conservatorship problems are out there and continuing. So on Wednesday, her father, Jamie Spears, filed court documents in which he said he was, quote, greatly saddened to hear of his daughter's suffering and difficulties, and he believes there must be an investigation into those claims. And what he's referring to, of course, was Britney Spears' testimony the week before, in which she talked about how she really wanted out of this conservatorship and how she feels that she doesn't have the rights that should be hers, just to individual liberty and freedom and personal agency. Particularly this point we talked about last week, in which she says she can't get pregnant because she has this IUD inside her that she's not allowed to remove because she doesn't have, she's not the decision maker about things that relate to her own body. Anyway, her father, Jamie Spears, pointed out in his filing that he's not the problem. He's not Britney's personal conservator. That's Jodie Montgomery. Jodie Montgomery then released a statement saying she had been a, quote, tireless advocate for Britney. And in response to the claim that she can't get married or have children, she said that Britney's choice to marry and start a family have never been impacted by the conservatorship, while she, Miss Montgomery, has been the conservator. So the whole thing seems very messy, very confused. This week, a judge again rejected Britney Spears' request to have her father removed as a conservator. What are we supposed to conclude here, Daniel?
This is unraveling, and we are going to get to the point where the conservatorship is done. It's just going to take time. Not long before we recorded this podcast, Bessemer Trust, which was the company that was approved to be the co-conservator along with Jamie of her estate, filed documents saying, you know what?
We want out.
Britney wants us out, so we'll be out. We will step aside. You can let us out of this. So it's going to take time. These things, mm-hmm. you don't just like sign a thing and everyone's like, this is a very complicated matter that involves a lot of people and a lot of money and a lot of entities, but it's going to get undone. It seems very clear now that we have.
Well, why, but let me ask a question. Why is the judge still rejecting the request to have Jamie Spears be the conservator if Britney Spears objects to him so strongly?
Because technically this was like something that was approved many, many months ago. And it was just sort of like signed yesterday. The timing, of course, being very strange and weird and delayed and makes it look
and feels like, very in your face for sure.
Yes, but this was actually decided months ago. And it was just sort of like, and it's like I said, it's the Bessemer who, like I said, today, literally on Thursday, July 1st, filed documents to say we want out. They are only just now getting in. They haven't even actually done anything yet. So that's part of this process of them coming in. So it's just, it's going to take some time, I think, but we are at the point now. If Britney is still under a conservatorship by the end of the year, I'll be surprised.
Okay.
I would think by the end of the year, this will get undone completely.
Okay. But then the bigger question is, what's up with these conservatorships? Like, not apparently they're not easy to get them applied for. And by all evidence that we're seeing, it's like friggin' impossible to get out of it. Like, what do you got to do? Who do you got to pay off, for God's sake? It's like the woman may, as we've discussed, right, may have emotional instability, may have, and by the way, many, many people in the world do, maybe even people on this podcast do, who knows? People need help. People are imperfect. People hide a lot of stuff, but she's well enough to state her opinion. She's well enough to perform and to, you know, for fans, and has no control over it. We talked about those things. So maybe I'm just saying, like, the conservator laws seem to be ripe for an overhaul.
Yeah, the personal conservatorship part for someone her age is particularly strange. And the fact that it's been in place for this long is also particularly strange. And you have to wonder what's been going on that Britney didn't even know.
No, she had
that
right
she could
to
get ever. Out of it. Yeah. Like, that seems very strange to me. So either she's so far gone that she can't pay attention to basic things, or people have been keeping it from her, which seems way more likely.
And that she's had very poor representation. Also, why hasn't she been able to choose her own lawyer? Also problematic for me. But this thing is like it's like you get thrown into the system, into the judicial system, and it's like, and then they forget about you. It's, you know, I think this is, and if nothing else comes from this whole thing with Britney Spears, is that, you know, a whole bunch of people who have the onus of the state weighing down on them without being able to get relief from that, and those people get a little bit of relief as a result of looking at this whole issue, then I think it's a good outcome.
Yeah, I think, like I said, I think the momentum is there now that this will be done, not quickly, but in due time. Yeah. All right. Our women trifecta this week. All right. It's so weird. I know. All right. So we are a week away from the release of Black Widow. And by all accounts, it's going to be well worth the wait. Reviews are in and they're overwhelmingly positive. 84% rating on Rotten Tomato. Scarlett Johansson, apparently fantastic. I can't wait myself. But one review kind of stood out from the rest, and it comes from Peter Bradshaw at The Guardian. The very first line, I'm going to read it to you, of the review is, quote, "The sensuous cough syrup purr of Scarlett Johansson's voice is something I've missed in lockdown. Now it's back with a throaty vengeance," end quote. The review went on to wonder if Black Widow's relationship with her father influenced her attraction to Bruce Banner. It did not use the term daddy issues, but it's heavily implied. And the review got plenty of backlash online. Screen Rant features editor Alicia Caruso called it effing creepy and added, quote, "I mean, honest to God, have you ever seen a legitimate professional female critic writing like this about male characters or actors in a review of a Marvel movie? No," end quote. Sharon, I know this one riled you up, so I'm going to ask you sarcastically, do you have a problem with this review?
No, I think maybe you misconstrued my thing with this. I just wanted us to write about it because I thought it was interesting that women had a response to this review. I don't personally have a response to this review. Guess what? Sounds like Peter Bradshaw thinks Scarlett Johansson is sexy, and I think there ain't nothing wrong with that. She is sexy, and she's a sexy superheroine, whether it's an issue and he's interpreting that she's got daddy issues and it has something to do with how she became a superhero. I also think that's okay. But I do note that a lot of women, and I would say that probably women of a younger generation than my own, are more sensitive to some of the stuff than I am, and will and tend to, you know, speak out on social media about things that they find problematic. I don't think, you know, men are going to be men, women are going to be women. There are instinctive and, you know, sexual overtones to lots of things in film and in television, and to ignore them is just to pretend, is to pretend, honestly. But what I do think it points out is that we just simply don't have enough women writing reviews of our movies and our television shows. And that's something that we have made a priority here at The Wrap. We have actually like intentional gender parity and diversity among our team of critics. And I don't know exactly who, I can't remember which critic reviewed Black Widow for us, probably our lead critic, Alonzo Giraldi, who's also a man. But in general, we just need that diversity of voices. And I think the more that we have that, who are less likely to point out Scarlett Johansson's, you know, throaty purr, the more, you know, the better off we'll be.
Yeah, I think that's a key element of this is a diversity of voices. And ironically enough, today, on Thursday, July 1st, on Vox, Carlos Aguiar, who has written some reviews.
He writes for us as well, yeah.
He does, yes. He wrote a piece called Who Gets to Be a Critic? And he talks about how he never believed that he could be one, because he just didn't think that someone with his upbringing, his background, he was a dreamer actually, could get into this business. And he writes about how he got in and how he felt like he snuck in somehow when he first started, and someone would realize he wasn't supposed to be there. So it's a really interesting analysis. And he talks a little bit about also the Variety review of Promising Young Woman that had, you know, sparked
some problematic, yes,
last year. So it's a really interesting piece. I recommend it. But yeah, I think that's the key point is, you know, we just need more diverse voices in every.
And I would just say, and not just diversity, and I'm very proud to have Carlos writing for The Wrap, reviewing films for us, but I would say specifically gender equity, because there is an overwhelming disproportion of white men who have been part of the class of critics over just historically. That's just the case. And so, not having, I can't tell you how many times in the past there's just been back talk between myself and colleagues over a guy reviewing a woman-oriented movie and just totally missing it, like not getting it and sort of and burying the movie. And it's, well, the movie wasn't made for you. You know, some movies are made for particular audiences. And if you have a Nancy Meyers film, it might be for men and women, but it might be more meaningful to women, for example, just one example, right? So, that can happen, but as long if you have a across the board, if you have gender parity or something close to it, then you'll get that variety of voices and variety of opinions, and maybe like, oh, some people don't like it, but some people do like it. So some people say this speaks directly to my heart. Thank you very much, Nancy Meyers, for doing a movie about middle-aged women, you know, going through changes in life or whatever it may be. Like, okay, it's totally boring to you, Daniel, and I totally get that. But it's super meaningful to me, and I would love to laugh hilariously at such matters. There we go.
And I think, you know, you can trace critics all the way back to creating movies. If the people judging your films are straight white men, you're going to be more inclined to make movies that appeal to straight white men.
That is so true.
So I think if you diversify the critics, you're diversifying the audience that then amplifies the films. And so now you are incentivized to diversify at the studio level. And I think it trickles all the way down. So, or back up, or however that analogy works. But seriously, yes, more diverse voices. All right. As always, we like to conclude this first segment with a little something we call Wax On, Wax Off, where we allow our founder and editor-in-chief, Sharon Waxman, the opportunity to sound off about something she is particularly into this week, her Wax On, and something she's a little more fired up about, her Wax Off. Sharon, as always, the floor is yours.
Thank you. This will be the Wax On, Wax Off, Me Too / BLM edition. Here we go. So for my wax on, hats off to Nicole Hannah-Jones, who got tenure at the University of North Carolina after being literally in a standoff with the board of that university. When Nicole Hannah-Jones, for those who don't know, is the creator of the 1619 Project, which she did in with the New York Times, that is a very formative and important piece of academic work, to reframe our history as a country, looking at it through the lens of the first year that slaves were brought to this country. And I think most people, most thinking people, regard this as a truly great contribution to understanding the damage that legacy has done to our country as a democracy. And of course, we all see the currents of that rippling through all the way until today. But the conservative forces at the University of North Carolina pulled her tenure, where she was about to go and become a professor at the University of North Carolina. And in a fairly bold move, she said, "If you don't give me tenure, I'm not coming." And they caved. They gave her tenure this week. Thought that was pretty interesting and shows that pushback sometimes works. But my wax off is there's been far more evidence this week that pushback by women and who speak out and speak their truth have a really hard time making the progress and making the gains that are achieved stick. It feels so much like it's two steps forward and four steps backward. So everything from Bill Cosby's reversal of his verdict and his release from prison, James Franco, who's a very good-looking actor, having to pay $2.2 million to make a lawsuit around sexual misconduct go away, everything to the discussion that we just had around Britney Spears and how powerless she seems to run her own affairs or make decisions that impact her own self, well-being, and identity, that has been reaffirmed as she does not have that agency. All those things are very discouraging. But it is, I will say, often the way that progress goes, is that it feels like it's one step forward and two steps back. But then comes the three steps forward, and that often happens. And I do believe that the Me Too movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, various movements, when you have people who are demanding the floor and demanding recognition and to be seen and heard, who have not been in the past, that it is a worthy battle, because ultimately, in the end, the progress does happen. It just happens in fits and starts. It's just never a linear line forward. There's always forces that will push us back. So this was a week when the forces pushed back on the progress that women have made. And that's my wax off.
All right, that'll do it for this week's Wax On, Wax Off. When we come back, the Rap's Emily Vogel will join us to discuss all things rap women and an interview with Leslie Headland, the first queer woman to lead a Star Wars series. Stay tuned.
Emily Vogel wears a number of hats here at The Rap. She runs our programming for our events, but kind of by accident, she started writing a Rap Women newsletter, which goes out to our women's community. She also leads our ambassador program, which is all about connecting young female leaders. And now she's going to be heading a podcast for women and about women called Unwrapped. The podcast is going to kick off in July, and here she is to talk about that. Hey, welcome, Emily.
Hey, thanks for having me on today. So excited to chat about the podcast with you guys.
Yeah. Tell us what it is and why you're doing it.
Yeah. So Unwrapped by Rap Women is going to be unwrapping everything from entertainment news and industry trends to career advice, Hollywood headlines, and much, much more. As Sharon mentioned, you know, after working on so many amazing Rap Women events and on the Rap Women newsletter and on the blog and with our ambassadors, I really realized that the industry is filled with so many incredible women who have so much knowledge and advice. Like, their heads are going to explode because they have so much wisdom and they just want a place to share it. And they want to actually, you know, when they're climbing this ladder of success in the industry, they're actually looking to reach back and help lift up this next generation and share their knowledge and advice with them. And then on the other side, you also have this group of women who are searching for that advice, who are looking to break into the industry. So you have this sort of supply and demand there. And I really want this podcast to be a platform and a place where those searching for the access and the knowledge and those with the knowledge and the access can really come together. And, you know, I may not have gone to film school or know how to produce a movie. So that's why we're going to be bringing in these experts for some really fun conversations. We're going to be revisiting some of our favorite moments from past Rap Women events. And it's just going to be really great. We're going to bring on new guests for some fun conversations. And hopefully our audiences will be able to learn a lot as well.
So who you got on deck for the first pod?
I can give you guys some. We're going to have some exciting guests coming up. We have a couple of topics and themes for our upcoming podcasts. We're going to be focusing on superheroes, both on and off the screen. So women who are playing superheroes, as actors, but who are also, you know, kicking butt in their daily lives as well. We're going to be speaking with showrunners. We're going to be talking about breaking into comedy, focusing on, you know, women in all of these musical shows, you know, whether that be, you know, Girls Five Eva or, this is so many avenues, Schmigadoon. So it's going to be really fun, and I'm really excited for everyone to listen.
Go ahead, Daniel.
No, I was going to. I didn't want to get into the news too quickly, but you know, I thought it was interesting to get Sharon. Yeah, we had Sharon's perspective about how this week in news felt so disheartening to women. Sharon is obviously of one generation, and Emily, you are of another. I'm curious,
I wasn't going to say I'm old enough to be your mother, but you know,
I wasn't going to say that. But I'm just wondering, you know, from your point of view, Emily, we had, you know, Britney Spears is fighting her conservatorship, Bill Cosby gets out of jail.
James Franco settles
a lawsuit. It was just a disheartening week for women. It was a shit week.
It was a shit week for women.
Yes.
Did you feel that?
There's a couple of different things I've been feeling. I think when it came to the Bill Cosby news, that one made me more feel a little like sick, I would say, like just really, yeah, like kind of sick to my stomach. Whereas the Britney thing made me feel more of just like sad, because obviously Britney was someone who I always, like, she was the first concert I went to, you know, we've been following her career. She's had so many comebacks. You know, I've been following her Instagram of these videos she's been posting. So that was just more of like sad, but at the same time, you know, looking back at the but last week and when she was giving her statements, you know, we weren't able to like hear what she was saying. So, you know, it's hard to like, we could read what she was saying, but we couldn't hear how she was saying it.
Right.
So, you know, maybe the way she was saying it didn't seem like she was okay. Like, you know, obviously, like, just because she was such like an idol of mine growing up, it's like, maybe this was the best decision for her. I mean, there are certain things where it's like the IUD thing, like that's still crazy to me. And like, I don't think that's okay. But, you know.
See, Daniel, you see?
No, that part I never argued with.
Okay. But I think like everything was just really, that news was actually pretty shocking to me. But so there's just a lot of mixed emotions when it comes to all of that news and it being a shit week for women.
Yeah, well, what I was just saying is that, you know, progress does tend to be, you know, two steps forward, one step back, even though this weekend felt like three steps back. But, you know, there's going to be a next week after this. And I do think it's a good place for us to have a safe space to talk about things like this. Among women and in a supportive way. And frankly, among all underrepresented groups who feel like you got to fight for you got to fight really hard for every win just to be able to be part of the conversation, you know?
Right. Exactly. And I think, you know, in my Rap Women newsletter that went out this week, you know, talked about, you know, it seems like almost like we kind of flashed back in time a little because Britney's dominating the news, you know, Nelly's back on the charts with his new song, you know, Bennifer's back together, there's all of these things, but then that feel like you're back in the 90s. But at the same time, you kind of have to think back to how much progress we have made since then. And that's what my newsletter focuses on this week is, yeah, sure, all these things are happening, but think about how far, you know, we have come, you know, this week, you know, announced like football's gay. And, you know, there's so many other great things happening that I think we do need to focus on all of the progress we have made.
So where can we find this podcast? It's called Unwrapped.
Yes. So Unwrapped will be, you'll be able to listen to it on, you know, rapwomen.com, on the rap.com, and wherever you are able to listen to your podcast, whether that be through Apple or Spotify, etc.
That sounds great. Okay. Well, we look forward to hearing your first kickoff. And I guess you can also sign up to the newsletter, to your newsletter at rapwomen.com. Is that right?
Yes. Be sure to sign up for the newsletter. And on that website too, you can access all of our fun blogs and learn about all of our upcoming events as well.
Great. Okay. Well, we can't wait to hear it, Emily. And good luck. Break a leg.
Thank you. Can't wait for everyone to tune in.
Thank you for joining us, Emily.
Hi everyone, I'm Jenny Moss here speaking with Leslie Headland. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to start off with, we are getting near the end of Pride Month, and I wanted to ask you what shows you think have made the biggest strides in terms of on-screen LGBTQ representation this year.
Veneno on HBO Max. It's not only one of the best shows I think I've ever seen, but it is a show that I think tells the trans experience, of course, but also an international multicultural experience for someone like myself that's like American and doesn't really know what it's like to grow up feeling different in another country. You know, like I only know what it's like to feel up feeling different here. So it was absolutely incredible. It's one of those stories that's so, it's almost like Aristotelian in the sense that it's so specific and it's so personal to the people telling it and to the subjects that they're, whose stories they're telling, that it actually ends up becoming incredibly universal. Like, you're just like, I was crying at the end of every episode. And I also suggested people in my writer's room, I was like, you guys should watch this show. And you know, it started to become a thing. Like, I'm crying. I'm at episode 4. You know, like I wanted to, you know, it was just great. I just think also it's the type of queer storytelling that I love, which is like leaning into camp and leaning into different types of melodrama as opposed to just telling something like super hyper realistically, which I think is, you know, there's always a place for that. That's really incredible. But I like in the tradition of like Almodovar, like there's something about utilizing genres that are usually reserved for us, either, you know, for women or for queer people, and then utilizing them in such a like highly stylized, beautiful way. So it was just hands down incredible.
So you brought up the writer's room. So now I get to bring up the writer's room for the accolade. But I actually just wanted to start off with a question that I feel like you get a lot already. So I'm going to ask if the question in and of itself is frustrating, which is, do you feel a level of responsibility as the first gay woman to run a project in the Star Wars universe? And the fact that question is going to be asked, does that in and of itself add a unnecessary level of responsibility? The fact that we have to talk about it because it hasn't happened before. And at the same time, the fact talking about it like reinforces that this is a big deal and it shouldn't be.
Yeah, it is an interesting question, actually, when you ask it that way. Yeah, it's interesting. It's like, it's interesting. You're right. A lot of people have asked me that and I've kind of given different answers to it. But when you phrase it that way, I do wonder why people are asking me that. Like, why aren't they asking Disney that question? Right. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like when people say, like, do you feel responsibility? Like, what are you going to do about it? Yeah. Now that you've been gifted this position, which I feel very grateful for, you know, for me, all I really feel is gratitude. I don't really feel like, you know, and the pressure that comes with creating anything, you know, like period, you know, let alone something as important as Star Wars. But you're right. There is this kind of like vibe of like, you know, be careful, you know, and you're like, what? Like they hired me, you know, like, it's just like, you know, I do wonder if it's like, should we be kind of asking the artists that question or should we be asking the studios and the corporations those questions and the networks those questions? Like, you know, and actually I think that they do get asked them pretty often, but I think that there's more of a responsibility in that hireable, that realm of hiring rather. I think for me, my job is to do my job, which is to create and show run and produce a show. And I think that there's an enormous amount of pressure that comes with that no matter what. Like, it's just very hard. It's a hard job. Because you're doing something creative in an industry that is not necessarily run by creative people. It's run by like economically minded people. And it's run by people that are, looking at art in terms of how many subscribers you get and like, how much money do you make? And, you know, it's kind of like any other industry that folds itself into capitalism. Like, you know, you just, the dollar becomes king, it becomes very important. And as creative people, we're not necessarily, that isn't necessarily why we got into this game, but it becomes something we have to start navigating pretty quickly. So yeah, there's always responsibility. I just think that as you work in a world, as your world gets bigger and as you go more and more professional with your work, like, yeah, it's just going to, the pressure is going to get higher no matter what.
For those who don't know, the Acolyte is set in the final days of the High Republic era, a period roughly 200 years before the events of The Phantom Menace. And the series will take the audience into a galaxy of shadowy secrets and emerging dark side powers, Disney Plus's words. So I wanted to ask you about what that period, what interests you about that, because we don't know any, like that's so different and important even to like the hardest core Star Wars fan to explore a period we haven't been to before is different in the Star Wars universe.
Well, it's interesting because I can't answer that question really. Like,
In order to answer it,
I'd have to answer it, which sucks. But what I can say is that, what I can say though is the reason it did appeal to me personally is that I was 18 when Phantom Menace came out, and so and I was a very, very big Star Wars fan. I remain a big Star Wars fan, but at that particular time, right after the re-releases, and the fact that I was, you know, in high school, like it just kind of all coincided at a time where I was like discovering who I was, you know. Sexually, I was discovering who I was artistically. I was kind of realizing what I wanted to do with my life. And then this like big, huge, you know, movie event, cultural event happened that was The Phantom Menace. And I know that like, you know, there were varying reactions to it. And certainly there were a lot of people that had grown up with the original trilogy who were disappointed by it. But I actually was very intrigued by why George Lucas had started us at that particular point. Like I kind of wondered like, but what happened to lead up to this? You know, like that's kind of where my Star Wars fan brain went, was like, how did we get here? And like, why are the Jedi like this? You know, like, why are they, you know, like when they are in power, like why are they acting this way, and how is it that they're not having the reaction that you would think they would to Anakin's presence and what Qui-Gon's saying about how passionately he feels about training him and bringing him into the fold? It's like there's, you know, even the discovery of Darth Maul is kind of met with this like interesting, you know, like kind of feeling. So I think for me, my brain has always buzzed around that area and kind of wondered like, you know, I wonder what's going on here or what has been going on here.
You were talking about the writer's room, and I saw that you said when staffing the writer's room, you looked for writers that also weren't as familiar with Star Wars. You looked for some writers who weren't familiar with it to offer like a different perspective. I just wanted to ask you about staffing the room in general for other ways that you looked for different perspectives, because I think it's interesting to have someone who's not as familiar with Star Wars come in and offer something just to make a show good in general. But what else you looked for when creating the writer's room for The Acolyte?
Well, you know, it was very, what I noticed was that most of the scripts, like the samples that I really responded to, they were Star Wars fans, you know, like most of the people that I met with, you know, were people that were either, you know, really big fans of the franchise, but maybe not as familiar with like Filoni's work, you know what I mean? Like, and Clone Wars and some of the, like hadn't played the video games, you know? And then there were people that like myself that have, you know, like, and have watched all of Clone Wars and played Fallen Order and played Knights of the Old Republic. And like, I've also done a lot of RPGs, including, you know, Edge of the Empire. So I was very like, you know, I kind of felt like I was very into Star Wars. So I didn't necessarily like look for people who were as into Star Wars as I was, as much as I was interested in why people were interested in Star Wars. So I really, it wasn't that I, you know, sought out people specifically who had not. It was more that I was looking for people who I responded to their work anyway. And then I was like, what's your way into Star Wars? Like, what's the parts of it that you find the most interesting? And like, everybody had a different answer, the people that I ended up hiring. And I think that if you have like-minded people, that's of course good. You know, you want to have people that, you know, respect the source material, who absolutely, you know what you're talking about. But at the same time, I think it's important that you have like some voices who are approaching it a little bit more as like, well, kind of like the way that maybe George Lucas approached episode 4, right? Like, which is like, you know, like when he wrote A New Hope, he doesn't know, like he's not approaching it like, well, in Star Wars, there's this thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's approaching it as like, this is like, you know, he's talked over and over again about his kind of inspiration for that film being from tone poems or from a school of cinema that was much more about visual representation of feelings. And of course the monomyth and, you know, all of that, and not from a place of, you know, I have an encyclopedic knowledge about an IP, which I think, you know, I have a pretty decent knowledge of it. I have a lot of people on my staff that do. Obviously there's people who work at Lucasfilm, that's their only job. So I felt really well supported in that sense. It was more like, hi, you don't know any of this. You know, what do you think about this storyline? What do you think about this character? Like, what do you think about this being like a major set piece? What do you think? That was kind of more important to me in scouting people out. Because I just felt properly supported in the other places. So I think a good leader and a good creator looks for people who are maybe coming from a different perspective than they are. I think another thing too is that one thing that I noticed when I told my friends who are not in the industry that I was working on a Star Wars project, I would ask them, I would be like, what do you think about Star Wars? Like, oh, well, I really like Marvel, you know, and it's like, well, why do you like Marvel and not Star Wars? You know, and they would say, well, because like, I feel like with Star Wars, you have to know a lot of stuff. And with Marvel, I don't really need to know a lot of stuff. And I was like, well, you actually don't need to know a lot of stuff with Star Wars. Like, I think you can enjoy it on a really like deeply emotional, like symbolic level. And if you have the extra information, you know what I mean? It becomes even more exciting. But that's not the way that people culturally look at it, I don't think. And so it was important to me that my show maybe poke through that a little bit. And so it's like, yes, of course, if you know certain things, then certain characters and certain aspects of the show are going to mean a lot more to you, but it should be able to work on someone that's a little bit more of a layman. I mean, I think that Jon Favreau did this perfectly with Mandalorian. Like, that was a show that in the second season especially really paid off if you're a Clone Wars fan and if you're a fan of the IP and of other parts of Star Wars media. Like, you're like, oh my God, that's great. Oh my God, that's great. Oh my God. You know, and then the end of season one with the Darksaber, you're like, oh my God, that's amazing. They're going to go in. So it's going to go in this place. Like, you start to know where it's going, or you start to anticipate where it's going. But also my mom can watch this Mandalorian, you know, like mm-hmm. my mom, who has like a passing understanding of what Star Wars is, can watch Mandalorian and really get invested in the central connection between the main two characters, because it's universal, because it's deeply, deeply emblematic, I think, of what George Lucas wanted to bring to the world when he created it.
Very secretive, I'm sure. Very little can be said here, but I wanted to ask how far you are in the casting process and what you're looking for in terms of just representation on screen, because Disney has kind of focused on the fact that it will be a female-led and female-centric show.
I can't talk about that. Okay. I want to, but I can't.
No problem. No problem. All right. That's fine. That was probably going to be the case. Okay. So now I'm going to move on to Russian Doll, which you might be able to talk about a little bit more. So we'll see.
Which of all these things I'm not allowed to talk about? It's like, why are we even talking?
You have the most top secret things to talk about. Okay, so for season two of Russian Doll, obviously it was one of several shows, all the shows, basically, that got held up by the pandemic, so we haven't had it in a long time. I wanted to know if at all how much that affected your planning for season two, if you had more time to think over ideas and write things, or if you wanted to do that, or if it was just a waiting game, figuring out what you guys were going to do.
You know, I can't, I don't know if I should speak to that like specifically, but I can definitely say that going into COVID and quarantine really did change the timeline for almost everything I was working on. So everything went from like, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, to like, slow down, slow down, slow down, slow down. So like, suddenly all of the things that felt like there was a big, like, deadline at the end of it, or there was a big flashing date that you had to hit something by, those all like disappeared because nobody could shoot. Like, nobody could really fly different places and pitch different things and go over different stuff. And so everything that usually felt like really, everything that usually felt like an emergency or that level of stress, you know, that became something that you could take more time with, and you could, approach in more of a, I guess I would say like holistic way, you know, because obviously we're always approaching our work thoughtfully, but a lot of the times you know, when you're working on a schedule, you have to like factor in the time frame of it as well. It isn't just like, oh, I'm going to do whatever I want. I guess there are some artists that do this. I don't know who they are. I'm definitely not one of them, but you know, I can do whatever I want when I'm done with my draft. I'll just send it in and we'll see what happens. Usually, you know, you're backing into some sort of a schedule. And one thing that was interesting about that time period was that it forced everybody to slow down, you know, like it forced everyone to reevaluate certain things. And it also was like a seismic shift culturally, you know, like, I just don't think the same things are important to us as a culture that were important to us. I mean, they're still important, but I think our priorities got a little like rearranged, I would say, at least for me personally. But I feel like when I go online and social media, or when I, now that we're kind of opening up back up and having, you know, more meetings in person and actually connecting with people, you know, you're hearing people talk about things in very different ways, like talking about, you know, racism and especially, you know, as something that white people are, I think, going, or at least my friends, I should say, who are white, are kind of going like, God, you know, like, I it kind of forced me to take a look at something when I wasn't distracted by everything else, you know, everything that happened last summer with the murder of George Floyd and the resulting, you know, activism and protests that happened. I think it really made people stop and go like, oh, wow, like I've been looking at my life in one particular way because I've just been driven by like, what's my next deadline? What's my next job? What's my next paycheck? And I think when it made everyone kind of stop for a second. And so the creative process, which is usually one for me that's pretty, it flows pretty well, that stop actually was kind of a blessing, because even though, you know, I pride myself on being someone that can deliver no matter what, like, and I'm like, I got it, I'm a straight A student, I can turn it in on time, because everybody else was like, hey, we're going to take a minute to kind of react to emotionally to what's going on here, and the fact that like hundreds of thousands of Americans are dying, and there's this huge social justice movement going on. Like, I think it just made everyone kind of stop for a second, and my artistic process 100% was affected by that. The way that I approach the artistic process now, the way that I approached starting, you know, my writer's room was completely different, because I had 6 to 9 months to really kind of sit there and think about some things and think about my choices, my life choices. So there was a lot of forced introspection there that I think was really helpful to both of those projects for me.
And then last question. I was very excited to see Annie Murphy joining the cast for season two. Big fan. And I wanted to ask about a show that we became so entrenched in these characters that we saw over and over and over, literally, in season one. And I wanted to ask about bringing in new characters in season two and what that's like, because the format, you know, got affected and broken in the final episode, and what that allows for in season two, getting new faces.
I mean, mostly it's like you get to work with like awesome people. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, you know, I think especially like a show like Russian Doll that I was just saying this to somebody today about it. It's like it was a show that I don't think Amy, Natasha or I ever thought would be a mainstream show. I think we kind of assumed it would be. I mean, maybe I don't want to speak for both of them, but I would say that like whenever I chatted about it with them when we were in, you know, pre-production for it or when we were working on the first season, it definitely felt like, you know, almost like an independent film. Like it just kind of felt like it's going to be this cool thing and like, you know, people will get it or maybe they won't, but it's also very weird and it's very odd and it's dealing with a lot of like pretty heavy issues. So all of those were things that I was like, I can't, you know, I kind of thought, well, we're going to reach some people, they're going to enjoy it. And that'll be that, you know, and it was this huge response, like just the fact that like there was a timing around it where I think we were all willing to talk about trauma in a way that like, especially culturally and like editorially, people, when they were talking about the show, identified those types of things. And I think Schitt's Creek was a similar thing where like, I think initially when those first few seasons started out on Pop TV, you kind of thought, you know, I mean, I liked it, you know, but it was also kind of this show that didn't necessarily translate to a mainstream audience. But as soon as it hits Netflix, you know, and as soon as, again, you know, we're kind of all sitting at home wondering what to watch and really kind of looking for something like happy and fun, you know, like, and something that's sort of life affirming in the midst of a lot of tragedy and a lot of sadness and depression, you know, that was a show too, that just came at the right time and like hit in a particular it hit us all, I think, in a particular way. So yeah, I think it's, I think that every step that Russian Doll takes now is like a really exciting one, because I don't think that anybody working on that first season kind of thought that it would have, I mean, we thought we were very proud of it, but I don't think we thought it would have the cultural impact that it did. So any opportunity to make it bigger and better the next time, which of course would include, you know, more people, as part of the cast, is just like icing on the cake.
Thank you for speaking so eloquently and diligently to things you can't answer.
I know. It's tough because it's like, it's also, it's so frustrating too, because like, I want to talk about all of it. You know, like, it's like, I always feel, I don't know if it's just the, in me, I'm just like, you know, I don't want to like be rude, you know, like, but I'm just like, I actually can't say anything. I'm not allowed to.
That's what makes it fun later. Yes, that's what makes it fun. The anticipation that we, I don't want to know, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
I do.
But also you kind of, like, no, I know exactly what you mean. You're kind of like, I mean, you just, there's so few things now with, you know, with our industry that are surprises, you know, you know, like, so it feels like, it does feel like something that even though it's like cagey and weird, ultimately it's for a good thing. Yeah. It's like planning a surprise party for somebody. It's like annoying, but you know, ultimately it'll be fun.
Honestly, getting the, I can't talk about that is just even more exciting for fans because you're like, okay, well then it must be really good.
It's like, oh my God, you know, who is she casting? She can't talk about anything? She can't give us anything? It's like, no, can't.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it.
And that is it for this week's episode of The Wrap-Up. Thank you to all of our listeners. And remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. See you next time.